Cúcuta border with Venezuela. So he's injected himself into opposition politics, into what was happening with Guaido at the border. So again, it's a very, very dangerous figure. Although he may have this delusional sense of himself and grandeur, he can play in that role because of U.S. policy.
And Miguel, we just have about less than a minute left, about 30 seconds. But the ability of the Maduro administration to continue to persevere in the face of a U.S. embargo, in the face of now of an indictment by the U.S. Government of Maduro himself. Could you talk about the ability of this administration to survive?
Well, I think that the key thing is that, again, most U.S. policymakers continue to look at Venezuela as Maduro teetering because, again, their main informants are Guaido and the opposition. Rather than open up space, rather than engage in conversation, in negotiations, Maduro actually still has military support. We saw that once again on Sunday when the so-called invasion happened.
We have 5 seconds, Miguel.
So I think it's fundamental to understand Venezuela needs negotiations and conversation, not invasions.
Miguel Tinker-Salas is a professor at Pomona College in Claremont, California, author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Public Schools will partner with DoorDash to deliver needed meals and school supplies to students. Some Oregonians will not receive stimulus checks because of their spouse's immigration status. And in international news, New Zealand has reported its second consecutive day without new coronavirus cases. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported on Wednesday 70 new confirmed coronavirus cases and 2 new coronavirus-related deaths, bringing the official count in Oregon to 2,916 known cases of COVID-19 with 115 deaths. OHA has begun releasing the number of coronavirus cases by zip code, which could help us understand the extent of the community spread of the virus. A Southeast Portland nursing home known to have had at least 28 people die from COVID-19 has been shut down by the state. Studies showed that employees at the home didn't wash their hands and failed to properly comply with social distancing. Some staff were only provided 1 face mask per shift, and they were apparently not trained in how to slow the spread of infection. At least 117 people there tested positive. Washington has just under 16,000 cases with 862 deaths. In the United States, over 1,220,000 cases have been confirmed, and at least 72,300 people have died. More than 1,000 additional deaths have been announced in the U.S. every day since April 2nd. Worldwide, the official count of coronavirus cases is nearly 3,007,000 people, with at least 260,600 deaths. The virus has been detected in at least 177 countries. Portland Public School students in need will be receiving learning materials and meals through the delivery service DoorDash. The Fund for PPS, the fundraising nonprofit for the school district, announced the partnership yesterday, where DoorDash will be used to reach students who cannot otherwise access PPS resources like meal sites. This includes immunocompromised students, students with special needs, or students who cannot easily access transportation. Since the governor closed schools, meal distribution sites for public school students have remained open, and the partnership with DoorDash means that students who cannot access these sites can still get service. DoorDash has already delivered Chromebooks, learning materials, internet hotspots, and meals to 450 students who would not otherwise have access. Some Oregonians will not get stimulus checks approved under the CARES Act because of the immigration status of their spouses. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Couples with mixed immigration status aren't eligible for coronavirus relief stimulus payments, and that's hitting some families hard. Jose Avalos is a U.S. citizen with three children who works as a housekeeper for Kaiser Permanente in Clackamas, putting him on the front lines of the pandemic. His wife filed for a visa in 2016 and is waiting for the paperwork to be finalized. She files taxes with an individual taxpayer identification number, an alternative to a Social Security number often used for people without legal immigration status. However, the CARES Act bars folks who file with I-10 from receiving stimulus checks. Avalos and his wife file taxes jointly.
That's why I found unfair. If you are a taxpayer, regardless of your situation, you should be receiving help.
There are 1.2 million U.S. residents married to folks who are undocumented, according to the Migration Policy Institute, which means they also could be missing out on coronavirus relief checks. The CARES Act authorized $1,200 checks for people making under $75,000 a year, and another $500 for each child. That would have made the Avalos family eligible for $2,700 of stimulus money. Their total income for a family of five was less than $40,000 in 2019. Avalos says his family and others need support during this crisis.
We got left behind, not only me, they left behind my family, my children, and they left behind hundreds of thousands of families in the United States.
Avalos says luckily Kaiser has been able to offer some help to employees. With children unable to go to school, the healthcare provider is offering families $300 a week for child care. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
New Zealand confirmed its second consecutive day without coronavirus cases. KBOO's Nat Moon takes a closer look at the reasons behind their success.
The country of New Zealand just had its second consecutive day of no new cases after just 7 weeks of fighting the coronavirus. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has won praise from around the world for shutting down the island nation of 5 million people in late March when New Zealand only had a handful of COVID-19 cases. New Zealand's government also quickly introduced measures to protect the country's economy, including subsidies to businesses to help keep 1.6 million workers employed. The country has had just over 1,100 COVID-19 cases and 20 deaths. Professor Michael Baker, one of the country's top public health experts, told Vice News, quote, "I think the critical success factors in New Zealand were good science and great leadership working together. And you can't succeed if you have one without the other." New Zealand's government is now exploring forming a travel bubble with the neighboring countries of Australia and the Pacific Islands in an attempt to gradually reduce lockdown measures. Similarly, the unincorporated U.S. territory of American Samoa, a group of islands located in the South Pacific Ocean, has been sealed off for nearly 2 months. Other U.S. islands like Hawaii have been unable to keep the infection out, but according to public health officials, American Samoa's success has been no accident. The territory moved quickly to halt incoming flights, rapidly boosted testing capability, and took advantage of social distancing strategies that had already been adopted in response to a measles outbreak at the end of last year. With no signs of local transmission of the virus, the territory of American Samoa remains the only part of the United States that is not under a major disaster declaration. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
With many nursing home residents feeling isolated amid coronavirus, AARP Oregon is calling on long-term care facilities to make sure they stay connected with family members. Eric Tegedoff has more.
AARP Oregon wants families with loved ones in nursing homes to consider asking more questions when working with facilities. Residents of long-term care facilities are one group known to be at a higher risk from the new coronavirus. As of mid-April, more than half of COVID-19 deaths in Oregon originated in these facilities. Volunteer State President of AARP Oregon, Elaine Friesen-Strang, says that's why it's important to know where the virus is.
We're really advocating that the names of facilities with confirmed cases must be made public on a daily basis. We need that information to make wise decisions.
Friesen-Strang says families should know if a resident, staff member, or vendor at the facility has tested positive for COVID-19. She says facilities also need to keep families connected through virtual visits, since in-person meetings have been halted for now and many residents are feeling isolated. AARP Oregon also wants families to ask about facilities' virus prevention methods, if they have enough personal protective equipment for both staff and residents, and if they're at full staffing levels. Friesen-Strang says that includes nurses and aides, and if they're short-staffed, inquire about plans to fill the gaps. She says AARP has been hearing from concerned families.
It can be very frustrating to advocate for your loved one when you're not allowed to go visit. And we know just by the sheer age of folks who generally live in nursing homes, by their underlying medical conditions, that they are more at risk.
She adds that if people are concerned about the safety of a loved one, they should reach out to Oregon's long-term care ombudsman. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
President Donald Trump hosted a Native American roundtable during a visit to Arizona on Tuesday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump signed a proclamation acknowledging missing and murdered Indigenous people Tuesday during a visit to Arizona, which included a roundtable discussion with Navajo Nation Vice President Myron Leiser and his wife Dottie Leiser and Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis. Dottie Leiser is an advocate working on missing and murdered Indigenous women issues. She told the president MMIW is a growing issue on the Navajo Nation. Here's part of her comments from a live stream of the meeting on C-SPAN.
You know, with the Ashlyn Mike case that came up in 2016, where she was kidnapped and raped and murdered in Shiprock, New Mexico, May 2nd, 2016. So that's kind of what opened the door for Navajo to start saying, okay, we need to do something, because that became the forefront. And so since then, the Amber Alert on Navajo Nation has gotten better, but still needs help with funding, still needs help with getting the data together.
The roundtable lasted about 30 minutes and included discussions about COVID-19, which has hit the Navajo Nation hard. This week, the number of positive Navajo cases exceeded 2,500. Tribes across the country have been waiting for federal COVID-19 relief aid. $8 billion is set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. President Trump commented about the funding, including the amount to the Navajo Nation, as he joked with Vice President Leiser.
This is the single largest investment in Indian country in our history. So the amount of money that's being sent to Indian country, as we call it, is the largest amount in the history of the U.S., and you deserve it, and you've been through a lot. The Navajo Nation will soon receive over $600 million. That's a lot. Can I renegotiate that? Can we renegotiate?
Only if we go up.
He said only if you go up. I understand. I've heard that before.
The Gila River Indian community is set to receive $40 million. Disbursement has been delayed. The Treasury Department announced Tuesday a plan to begin payments to tribes, which includes holding back amounts for Alaska Native corporations due to pending litigation. More than a dozen tribes sued over the inclusion of Alaska Native corporations in the funding. Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis commented about the funding at the end of the meeting, urging for the immediate release of the money and also saying the $8 billion is woefully inadequate to meet the needs of tribes.
You know, so today your administration made a significant impact across Indian country. And I want to thank you for getting some of the money out today. I want to thank you also because we need help now. Indian tribes, and can't wait for that litigation to end before additional payments are made to us from the fund. And if you can, please direct Treasury to make these payments as soon as possible.
Governor Lewis also asked for a cap to be put on the amount any one tribe receives and to allow tribes to have flexible guidance to keep their governments running. The Treasury Department's plan is to begin allocating 60% of the $8 billion this week to tribes. The president of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota declared an immediate lockdown of a community Tuesday due to COVID-19. President Rodney Bordeaux, in a social media message, declared the lockdown of the Spring Creek community due to a high exposure of COVID-19. Law enforcement will be monitoring roads and no one will be allowed in or out of Spring Creek. The message states the lockdown is to protect the rest of the communities from the spread of COVID-19. The tribe will assist people in need of food and supplies. No other information was shared. A number of tribes in South Dakota have taken emergency measures to address COVID-19, including the Oglala Sioux Tribe, which issued a reservation-wide lockdown, and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe monitoring borders among several of its emergency measures. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Adrian Brown, a practicing attorney running for the open judicial seat in Multnomah County Circuit Court. And after that, we'll hear news from the Boo, your news from inside KBOO, at 7 Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 41. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 74 degrees. Today is International No Diet Day, an annual celebration of body acceptance and diversity. Today, we challenge you to question the idea of the, quote, right body shape, and to unconditionally accept and love your body in all its beauty and usefulness to you. The quote of the day is from human rights activist and writer Audre Lorde, who said, quote, "Nothing I accept about myself can be used against me to diminish me." The R Institute, a conservative policy group, was involved in a report about how much funds are needed to secure this year's elections. With more on the story, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The problem is that a whistleblower takes so much of a risk in coming forward in this political environment. Toxic political environment. It's very dangerous because particularly anything that is critical of the Trump administration is like throwing a match into a pool of gasoline.
That's journalist Marcia Mitchell, who's reported extensively on whistleblowers, on Dr. Rick Bright filing an official whistleblower complaint yesterday. The former head of the Health and Human Services effort to develop a coronavirus vaccine was recently demoted. Dr. Bright alleges it was retaliation for his resistance to funding, quote, potentially dangerous drugs promoted by those with political connections and by the administration itself, unquote. Last week, it was Health Department Inspector General Christy Grimm. Mitchell fears these won't be the last ousted.
We're so accustomed now to hear things like this, and I'm afraid that not enough attention will be paid.
Mitchell says the Trump administration has a pattern of disregarding oversight. A White House memo informed congressional staff this week that coronavirus task force experts will need special permission to testify before Congress. President Trump explained, while boarding a plane for Arizona, his first big trip since the pandemic, telling reporters Dr. Anthony Fauci was not allowed to testify before a House committee last week because its members are, quote, Trump haters, unquote. The president has also made unsubstantiated claims that voting by mail leads to high rates of voter fraud.
I think, for example, with respect to vote by mail, some Republicans oppose it because they think that it means that they'll do worse. And I don't think that that's really a just or moral motivation, but I also think it's not true. I mean, Utah has vote by mail and the Republicans win there all the time.
Paul Rosenzweig is a cyber and national security researcher with the R Street Institute, a conservative-leaning policy group.
Election security has somehow become a partisan issue with disagreements about it seeming to break along political lines. And I don't believe that that's the right answer. I believe that the right answer is for the election to be free and fair and open.
Rosenzweig joined other think tanks on a report outlining the massive investments needed to secure elections this year, much more than the $400 million Congress has allocated so far.
That doesn't mean I've, you know, stopped being a conservative. I haven't. I like to think that if my ideas are sufficiently persuasive in other political areas, you know, we'll win the election.
In other news, former Vice President Joe Biden is the first major party's candidate to have a collective bargaining agreement with unionized field organizers. And yesterday, New York District Judge Annalise Torres ordered election officials to hold the Democratic presidential primary after a legal challenge to the Board of Elections' decision to cancel it. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Last month, immunology expert Dr. Rick Bright lost his position as director of the Federal Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. Yesterday, he filed a whistleblower complaint against the Trump administration. Dr. Bright claims his reassignment was in retaliation for objecting to President Trump's insistence that the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine was effective at treating COVID-19. He also said he had faced sustained pressure from the Health and Human Services officials since the beginning of the Trump administration to steer millions of dollars in contracts to the clients of lobbyist and Trump supporter John Clarkey. Among several examples in his 89-page report, Bright wrote that HHS officials urged him to transfer $40 million to the Strategic National Stockpile in 2018 to purchase a drug made by one of Clarkey's clients. Bright also encountered pushback in January when he called on HHS to begin developing resources in preparation for treatment and vaccine research as the COVID-19 pandemic reached the United States. He is scheduled to testify to Congress as early as next week. A new bill may help small business and nonprofit owners who have been virtually shut out from receiving aid from the government so far related to coronavirus. KBOO's Nat Moon has the story.
Despite more than $720 billion supposedly set aside to help small businesses recover during the pandemic, many businesses and nonprofits have been completely shut off from receiving any support. A new bill from Senator Kamala Harris and Representative Ayanna Pressley aims to help fix the disparity with a new bill called the Saving Our Street Act, Vox reported today. The bill targets microbusinesses that had to compete against larger companies whose applications for aid were often prioritized by banks. 75% of this new bill is designated for businesses and nonprofit owners from underrepresented groups, which includes people of color, women, and veterans, among others. Experts recently estimated that up to 90% of women and minority business owners were unable to secure pandemic funding in the first round because of the way the program was set up. To qualify, businesses must make less than $1 million in gross revenue per year, and nonprofits must bring in less than $500,000 in gross annual receipts, and both must have fewer than 20 employees. Publicly traded companies and hedge fund-owned businesses are explicitly excluded. Businesses and nonprofits that qualify for the grants could obtain up to $250,000 each to cover costs like payroll, rent, and utilities. Of course, like most measures that are intended to make things better for more people, the bill is likely to face considerable pushback from the Republican majority in the Senate. For KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Last night, Judge Annalisa Torres of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York ordered state election officials to restore Senator Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang, and other Democratic candidates, to the state's 2020 presidential primary ballot. In her ruling, Torres wrote, quote, "The removal of presidential contenders from the primary ballot not only deprived those candidates of the chance to garner votes for the Democratic Party's nomination, it deprived Democratic voters of the opportunity to elect delegates who could push their point of view in that forum." The Board of Elections was given the authority to remove candidates other than Biden and to effectively cancel the presidential primary in a rider in a budget measure Andrew Cuomo signed into law last month. Andrew Yang, who had sued New York for removing him and other candidates from the ballot, tweeted last night, quote, "I hope that the New York Board of Elections takes from this ruling a newfound appreciation of their role in safeguarding our democracy. The State Board of Elections is expected to appeal Judge Torres' decision." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael asks, who was that unmasked man?
Yesterday, Trump visited a factory making masks, not masked himself, talking over heaps of masks, unaware of the PA system blaring Guns N' Roses' Live and Let Die, maybe his 2020 campaign song. With personal stock profits and pork-laden relief bills, the Repubs get an A for opportunism and an F in compassion. In this government, if you don't genuflect, you don't collect. And the big cities and populous states with the most virus aren't Trump supporters, so Alaska gets 125 times more aid per positive test than New Jersey or New York. The virus has brought out the best in people. Caring, creativity, sacrifice for others. Governors open up states and people say, whoa there, Hoss, not ready yet. But in the end, we all have to eat. The wolves of debt don't see virus, only easier prey. And while this is a huge country, each neighborhood is like a cruise ship where no one can avoid breathing in a little of what everyone else breathes out. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Proposals to guarantee paid time off in order to care for a sick family member are gaining support as a result of the pandemic. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Some 83% of voters in three states considered key to the 2020 election support the idea of a national paid family leave program, according to a new survey. In the poll taken in Arizona, Iowa, and North Carolina, almost 90% of women, African Americans, and Hispanics said they support family leave. Katie Bethel with the Paid Leave for the U.S. Action Fund also notes support stands at 80% among non-college educated voters.
And these constituencies are important in the context of the election and in the context of who is providing care to people in this crisis. These are really the communities who understand firsthand why paid family and medical leave is so important.
One in four people who responded to the survey said they've already had to take unpaid family leave during the COVID-19 crisis or think they'll need to take it soon. The Family Act, which would establish a national paid family leave program, awaits a vote in Congress. Opponents claim such a program would be too costly. But Bethel says the pandemic has made it painfully clear why the U.S. needs a permanent national solution for paid family leave.
We propose an insurance system run by the federal government, the same as unemployment insurance and Social Security, that everybody pays into, and then that money is there when you need it.
California was the first of eight states plus D.C. to establish its own state-run system for paid family leave. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Yesterday, Vice President Mike Pence and other White House officials said the COVID task force would be shutting down around Memorial Day. Today, President Donald Trump said the task force would continue indefinitely, but would focus more on the economy than the virus, with some changes in the task force membership. Trump said, quote, "Will some people be affected badly? Yes, but we have to get our country open, and we have to get it open soon." Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, testified today on Capitol Hill that, quote, "the war against COVID will be long and difficult." You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, we'll hear Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history to the latest world events. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with your host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, and tomorrow it will feature interviews with authors Hannah Lilith Asadi and Ashi Obejas on their recent contributions to the story anthology Take Us to a Better Place. At 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, featuring an interview with Dr. Tabiti Lewis, author of Ballers of the New School, Race and Sports in America. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's a rare occurrence when there's more than one candidate running for a Multnomah County Circuit Court judge position. For the election coming up on May 19th, there are five candidates, all vying to fill Circuit Court Judge Position 12. We're fortunate to have one of those candidates with us today, Adrian Brown. Adrian's been an assistant U.S. attorney in Oregon for the past 12 years, serving as the department's civil rights coordinator. She's also handled cases involving the state's mental health system, Portland police practices, and disability access. She previously worked for 7 years as a lawyer in the U.S. Air Force, where she served as a counsel for Air Force personnel. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us this morning via Zoom.
Thank you for having me.
Adrian, I mentioned in the intro that in almost every case, a candidate for a circuit court judge position runs unopposed. Why are there several candidates this election for position 12?
Yes, it's an excellent question. And this is a unique opportunity for voters because there was no incumbent that is running. So it was an open seat that came about very, very late December when the incumbent decided that he was going to retire. And he is waiting to retire until after the election. So he didn't put his name in for re-election, and it created an open seat. And there were several interested people who had been working their way through the appointment process, I being one of those persons. And I think we all saw it as an opportunity to seize that just rarely comes around.
Now, can you tell us first a little bit about the responsibilities of the Multnomah County Circuit Court judge? This is a municipal court, and you cover both Portland and Gresham?
Yeah, the entire Multnomah County. So some folks that are not familiar, and lawyers as well, sometimes don't even realize, because judicial elections are so rare, that the circuit court in Multnomah County covers every town, from the West Hills and beyond to, like you said, Gresham and Troutdale and Fairview. So it is the entire Multnomah County that gets an opportunity to vote. It's a nonpartisan race, so no matter what party you're affiliated with, this race will appear on your ballot. And it's one of about 30, I think there's 36 judges. I could be wrong about that in Multnomah County. I haven't checked my stats recently on that, but there are many judges to choose from. But for this race, this will be only one in Multnomah County that will be contested. And what we do is a range of both civil and criminal matters that would come before us. So each judge that sits on the circuit court typically is assigned cases through the presiding judge, and right now that's Stephen Bouchang. And the presiding judge will assign cases based on workload and experience. And, you know, he's not gonna assign a new judge right out of the gate, probably a murder trial. But he also is going to, usually when there can be an ability to select a judge, for instance, in a family matter, that's going to go to a judge that is in the family court docket. So those judges are a bit unique because they specialize in those areas. That's not to say a circuit court judge in the general docket isn't going to get one of those cases, but the juvenile and the family court matters are the only ones that are kind of carved out. Everyone else, it's very much the full range of issues that may appear in our society will come before a circuit court judge.
Now, you're currently in a very important role, working in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office for Oregon. Can you give us an example or two of the civil rights cases you've handled?
Yes, and I have had an extreme honor in working in this capacity. I am very grateful that I have been around a variety of folks in the U.S. Attorney's Office that have been very supportive of this work in our community. And we really bring in the range of issues depending upon what's happening out there to individuals. So we rely a lot on what the community is telling us that they need and desire to have brought forward to the public eye. And that's been everything from, you mentioned a little bit in the opening, looking at how the ADA is implemented, the Americans with Disabilities Act is implemented on the service delivery for people that are in mental health crisis or that need mental health services, and then all the way to looking at the pattern and practices of policing under a different statute that's shorthand is 42 USC 14141, and that's the shorthand. So there's a variety of federal statutes that work to help the most vulnerable members of our community. And those, you know, came about in the great era of the civil rights movement, and they continue to evolve. So even, you know, just, you know, for instance, the ADA was not passed until 1990. And many people see that as a law that has been around, and it has been around for a while. We're getting ready to celebrate the 30th anniversary. And so I think that we often don't realize that this is an ever-evolving issue. Civil rights is something that it wasn't just static during the civil rights movement. It's continued to evolve. And for instance, in the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Hate Crimes Act of 2009, for the first time, people who are LGBTQ were finally recognized as a vulnerable class of citizens that was being targeted. And, you know, many people, you know, we shouldn't forget that James Byrd, you know, died a horrific death as a result of his race. And that is also, you know, in that Matthew Shepard James Byrd Hate Crimes Act. But what was different was for the first time that sexual orientation was recognized as something that needed to be sought after in our community to protect the civil rights of individuals, of all individuals that are vulnerable.
I should mention that you were awarded the Justice Department's highest award for attorneys, the John Marshall Award, and that was for a case involving discrimination against Oregonians with developmental disabilities. So you have quite a bit of experience there. And would there be similar cases that would be brought before the circuit court?
There could, yes, certainly. For instance, I know that housing cases, discrimination in housing is something that we have a much more robust protection in Oregon. You know, the Oregon Fair Housing Act covers a wider range of people in protected classes than the Federal Fair Housing Act does. So that's an example. And certainly there is a range of employment discrimination cases that can go on where plaintiffs have been discriminated against based on the range of protected classes covered. So those types of cases, yes, absolutely, civil rights cases come before judges. Now, there can sometimes be a choice of forum where individuals or plaintiff's attorneys decide that, you know, they might want to bring it in federal court, but there are often times where the case can go either way in state court or federal court.
Now, here's the big question that I'm sure you get asked every single interview. Given your success, especially helping people as an assistant U.S. attorney, why run for the circuit court judge position?
So one of the things that I have found through my work in community engagement is how important the granular level of individuals and the choices and the consequences that they face matters most at the local level. That's where change is made. And in 2017, I realized I wanted to be more involved in my local community. And the way to do that with the experience that I bring to bear was to seek out opportunities where I could be a leader and still make a difference in the local level. And there's a variety of ways that one can be a leader, right? There are amazing advocacy organizations and amazing nonprofits and other agencies. This was an opportunity for me, given that I have worked in every side of the bar, from being a prosecutor to being a criminal defense attorney, working on the civil plaintiff side of enforcement, as well as working in defending civil actions. And I saw this as an opportunity to bring all those skills together and be a leader. And so that is why I'm seeking. I want to make a difference in my community. And I realized at the local level that this is where the heart of it happens.
You also have a personal story I read about, and there was a video on your website about being raised, you and your sister, by a single mother. And a judge apparently played a big part in improving your life at that time. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, yes. So, and this is when we tie everything together and you look at why does a person pursue the things that she pursues, the reason why I have, I think, a lot of interest in public service and interest in helping individuals is because I saw that, I witnessed that with my mom. So my mom fought to get child support in the day when it wasn't a mandatory requirement as a part of divorce to have that resolved. After years and years of broken promises from my father, my mom, by the time I was a teenager, finally was able to get into court and just do the fight that it was going to take, because my dad challenged it every step of the way. And by this time, we had probably about at least 10 years, maybe more, of unpaid child support. And a judge in that case, based on the advocacy of the attorney that represented my mother, and then the leadership of the judge, not only awarded child support, but awarded those years of arrears. And it was through a garnishment order. My dad's wages were garnished. That was how we finally got justice. And so that showed me that judicial leaders can make a difference in people's families, and that you have an opportunity to do the right thing for the right reasons, because the judge didn't have to do that. He could have awarded child support going forward, he could have ordered just a portion of the years, but he ordered it all the way back, and it made a big difference in the lives of my sister and I, my mother.
And Adrienne, you're now a mom yourself. You mentioned just before we started recording, you had peanut butter with your four-year-old today. Has that experience of raising a child yourself influenced your perspective as an attorney and maybe how you'll do your job as a judge?
Yes, absolutely. I came to being a mother very late in life. I didn't have my son until I was 40. And that was a decision that I felt very, very strongly about at that age, because I had given myself an opportunity to have and build a career and be a provider for my child in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do at age 25. And at the same time, I know that I would have had more energy at age 25 as well. So there's the pros and cons of waiting, but I consciously wanted to know that I had roots in my community and a secure foundation to raise my child. And so what it's done for me is it's given me wisdom and patience in ways that I wouldn't have had earlier in life. And now being able to see how a child grows and thinks and develops is life-changing, in the sense that you can forever be enriched by giving back to a child. And when I thought that I wouldn't have any more time to give when I became a mother, I realized I wanted to give more, because I found so much joy in it. And one of the things I've done to continue giving is I am a volunteer for SMART, which is a home-based a nonprofit here out of Oregon, Start Making a Reader Today. And what that program does is go into schools to just read with kids. So you pair as adults with kids, usually kindergarten up to third grade. And the reason why that age is so important is because it's the time when a child learns about the joy of reading, not reading because you have to, not reading because you are trying to learn. You're reading because you're interested in being with people and sitting down. And so I realized that I could give that back because I had my mom who did that for my sister and I. Even when she was single and raising us, going to grad school, she still made time to read to us at night. That's a very special memory I have. And now I get to do that for my son. And being a smart volunteer reader, at least until COVID-19, I was doing that twice a month at Boise Elliott School, and I really, really enjoyed. So being able to give back and enriching actually makes you want to do it more. Even though you have less time, you find time.
We've been talking with Adrian Brown, one of five candidates for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12. You can find out more about Adrian on her website, adrianforjudge.com. And remember to vote in the upcoming Oregon primary election. You can mail your ballot back by May 14th or bring it to any official ballot drop site by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth. Thank you.